Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Peggy Scott Laborde, author of The Fairgrounds Through the Lens, Photographs and Memories of Horse Racing in New Orleans. We'll also talk with Dan Bright and Justin Noble, co-authors of The Story of Dan Bright, Crime, Corruption, and Injustice in the Crescent City. Historian Peggy Scott Laborde is known for documenting beloved places and the culture of New Orleans in films and books on subjects as diverse as Christmas, lost restaurants, and Mardi Gras. And that's in addition to serving as senior producer of New Orleans public television station WYES and host of the long-running arts program Steppin' Out. Today, we're celebrating her Emmy nomination for New Orleans and the Mississippi. This fall, Peggy's back with a wonderful look at one of New Orleans' most cherished and thriving landmarks in a new book, The Fairgrounds Through the Lens, Photographs and Memories of Horse Racing in New Orleans. Peggy, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's great to be back, and it's nice to have a reason to be back.
Yes, it is. This book is so much fun.
Oh, I'm
for
so glad.
For anybody who's been to the races or been to Jazz Fest, and there's so many pictures. And I love that the principal photographer, Lewis Hodges Jr., now has a family who's into the third generation of taking pictures at the track.
Oh, it's so impressive. This, not too surprisingly, is inspired by a documentary I did a few years back. And I interviewed him. And not only, of course, are there fantastic photos in the course of, you know, almost over half a century, but Lou had a lot to say.
Yeah.
So we got to know each other pretty well. And I kept thinking, if I ever do a book, and fortunately the fine folks at Pelican Publishing noticed that I was doing the documentary and said, hey, what do you think about a book? And I just thought it was just a natural, because I can never do one of these books alone, you know. Fortunately, I have the day job, which I love. But it made sense because, you know, he has been chronicling the track with his family for many years.
But it goes so much farther back than that. This is a really long history, a long period.
It is. They officially call, you know, the 1870s, the beginning of what is known as the fairgrounds, but it really goes way back, really more like the 1850s, under different names, the Union Course, the Creole Course, you know, the fairgrounds. And so because of that, it's officially the third oldest thoroughbred racing track in America, but I think it's really the oldest.
We'll cherish that idea for a while.
It's so hard to imagine this kind of piece of property in the middle of an historic city.
Yes.
And in an historic neighborhood. You know, it's sort of under your nose to have this much property, almost 150 acres in the middle of New Orleans, and so beautiful. And so a lot of people just know it is the place for the Jazz Fest.
Well, you look at it from so many interesting angles. You look at it from the architecture of the building, the barns, the neighborhood, the owners, the jockeys, the horses, and you take it through the big fire of 1993 and the comeback after Katrina. There's a lot of history packed into this book.
Man, and I mean, it is a drama, okay? Because, yeah, it's like all these bad things, fires first and foremost, because the track and the structures throughout its history, you know, everything that was made of wood, especially in the olden days, was flammable. And but to think about that fire, which many of us remember that fateful December night. You could smell it, you know, if you weren't too far by. I was at work in Lakeview, you know, at WYES, and that's not far from the track at all, of course, you know. But it was very, very sad. But how it bounced back, primarily through the efforts, I mean, I'm sure of many people, but the Krantz family, who were the owners of the time, I think they did a remarkable job and had such challenges rebuilding, because when you rebuild, you want to go bigger and better.
Of course.
And being able to do that, it took a while. But I think they did a marvelous job. But also the recoup, they were back up and running, because you remember they were in the middle of the season. They were back up and running within just a few weeks, thanks to people like Quint Davis and his incredible crew who had access to these enormous tents. So you had a temporary facility in terms of, you know, where you could go place the bet. Fortunately, the track itself was not at all affected by it, but the place where people go and bet certainly was.
Now, Peg, one of the things I love about this book is that it's such a pleasure to browse through it. You know, it has that kind of scrapbook feeling of, you know, short memories, wonderful photographs to look at, but you do some really interesting long pieces. And one of the ones that I found most interesting was the interview with Tom Amos, because it gave you a sense of what the life of a trainer is like at the track.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, you know, I had this wonderful interview with him that I thought, this, you know, we can only use bits and pieces in the show, okay, but there needs to be a home for this. And so I decided to go ahead and do that in some instances to include more of it. And I was just mesmerized. First of all, what a nice man, and somebody who by high school was exposed to this through his good friend Al Stahl, whose family has been very involved with the fairgrounds for a long time. And he was hooked. And he just loved the beauty of the horses. And I love that some people refer to a horse as an athlete. I think an athlete is being a human being, but they are the athletes. Okay, now let's give the jockey some credit too. Okay, because anybody who can mount an animal that's 1,500 pounds and show them where to go is no easy feat. But he had a lot to say, a lot of insight.
Some of the things that struck me were his wonderful descriptions of morning at the track. You know, how you have 50 horses in the barn, you run 5 of them at a time. Some of the most wonderful photographs in this book are of morning at the track.
They really are. You know? Oh, Lou did a great job of that, and Alex Barkoff and Amanda Weir, they did a great job of that. Now, I actually, because we were doing the documentary, got up really early one morning, which is very atypical, and I went and visited with Tom, and he took us around, and what a great experience that was to see the track wake up. And there's a lot of activity. It's still a little dark. And then, of course, dawn breaks through. But those horses have got to be taken care of and ridden every day. All the care that goes into it. Wow. And so, yeah, it was pretty eye-opening. And, of course, if the name Amos sounds familiar, a very fine New Orleans family. His older brother, Jim Amos, was the head of the Tom Speaking Union for a long time. And his mom is a children's book author.
Well,
so,
and
Stan was the head of Likes Brothers. So pretty illustrious family.
Well, really gives an insight into that kind of life. When he talks about moving the horses, particularly here for the season, I was just turning pages like, oh, so this is how they do all that. It's amazing. And it's such a labor of love. And I think that really comes through in the interview with Evelyn Benoit.
Who is, as we should say, in the Who's Your Mama school, you know, Tab Benoit's mom.
Oh, but she is incredible. And to think about, she has over 70 horses. For folks maybe who, for the uninitiated here, may not realize is that when you have horses, you hire a trainer. And a trainer, you pay the trainer to take care of them and to run them and to facilitate the racing of it all, too. But she's a great lady. She really is. And takes care of her family, the track family, as well as her family. She has many children, really big family. And they're all kind of involved in terms of the cheering on, and the horses are named after, you know, members of the family. But she is somebody who's been a really strong proponent of the success of the fairgrounds, and sometimes even making suggestions about, you know, to management what they ought to do to get more people in. Because as we all know today with the internet, modern technology, you don't have to be at the track to bet.
Right.
You know, long gone are the days of the bookies too. Okay, well, that's a colorful history, which we do talk about. But, you know, she is really trying to encourage, and it's true, it attracts all over the country, have to make it fun. There are bands, there's good food, there's other things in addition to the racing, which is magnificent, but you have to have more because you could easily do it by the internet.
Well, and the other thing I loved was that story about when she was a little girl and she went to the race and she wrote, "I will be back with a horse" on the finish line post. Oh, that was such a great story.
Thank you. Yes, she is really amazing. She's so devoted. Oh, the other thing is when she has a horse that wins, she has all of her family in the winner's circle to take the picture. And even if you're not the immediate family, if you're just a fan, she'll drag you into the picture too. She shares that joy. She likes to do that.
Now, you even have some wonderful biographies of horses in this book. And everybody knows about Risen Star, I think. But I was quite moved by that story of Evelyn's horse, Star Guitar.
She adores that horse, and that horse is still alive and well on the North Shore. And, you know, something else for somebody who hasn't grown up at the track, there's so many different aspects to the business. And, of course, one of them is breeding, you know, and that's a magnificent horse. And so that horse travels, or other horses travel to that horse. But that was very interesting, this whole other thing, because it's a very expensive proposition to have these horses. But she's a lovely lady, and that horse, there's now the Star Guitar Bar. Okay, that's it. So I guess she bought a sponsorship at the fairgrounds. But yeah, she's very devoted to Star Guitar.
Now, the other thing is that this place is so woven into the lives of New Orleans families, the rhythms of the city. I love the way you talk about Thanksgiving and how many people celebrate Thanksgiving at the track.
Oh, yes. And also the whole tradition of wearing hats. There are two times a year where it's especially fun to wear a hat. And when I say a hat, it doesn't have to be a fancy hat. It could be a silly hat, too. But that is the sort of the ceremonial opening day. Now, actually, the track actually opens like the Saturday before, but that's okay. That's the day. And people wear these great hats, also for Louisiana Derby Day, which is almost like the ceremonial closing of the season. But there's wonderful traditions. Like, for instance, an uptown young lady had their Deb party in honor of their coming out at the track, you know, ladies' luncheons. But it's not just uptown society. It's everybody can go. And that's the other thing. It's a really good value. You can go to the clubhouse, but the grandstands are quite nice too. And sometimes I prefer to the grandstands. It just depends. If it's a special event, that's something else. The other thing is there are rituals. When you go out there, you've got to have the corned beef and cabbage. That's right. One of the ritual traditions are very important.
And also, you really document that wonderful transformation of the track to Jazz Fest. That's
amazing.
So much work.
Yes, it is. And Quint Davis and his crew have been doing this for a long time, and a lot of the people have done it since day one. But, you know, some people have only gone to the track for Jazz Fest. And so one of the things that was very important to myself and to Lou Hodges is to show photos of during the track meet and during the Jazz Fest. And when you see the juxtaposition of that, it's really quite fun.
Or when you see this, you know, set up in fast forward, it's really an amazing thing.
Yeah, and the finish line.
Too.
When you see the sign, you know, the pole that says finish line, and then it's right next to the Economy Hall Jazz Tent, where Michael White is playing so wonderfully. It's quite a mix.
Now, you said this was a little outside your comfort zone because you didn't grow up at the track. So what has it done for you? Did it turn you into an avid fan?
It did. And I'm not even talking about the betting because I'm not exactly a big bettor. I mean, I would bet, you know, make $2 at a time. But it was outside my comfort zone. It sort of fell in my lap very nicely. And I'm most appreciative for that because I've learned a lot about this whole other world. And I, too, was primarily familiar with the track because of Jazz Fest.
Well, now you've been.
Love it.
This is a great story. It's full of great New Orleans characters, a lot of New Orleans history. You can't miss with this pick.
Well, thank you, Susan. And I hope it encourages people to come out because it really is a wonderful opportunity. There's so many things in New Orleans that people can go do. I know there's a lot of competition for the leisure dollar. You know, you get to be outside. You get to be healthy. Okay. But you watch these races and you just have a whole lot of fun.
Oh, passion of a convert. I can see it.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Peggy Scott Laborde about her wonderful new book, The Fairgrounds Through the Lens, Photographs and Memories of Horse Racing in New Orleans. You can meet her when she appears at Octavia Books Saturday, November 19th at 1 o'clock. Thanks so much, Peg.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Susan. Thank you very much.
Run, old Molly, run, old Molly, run. Tinbrook's gonna beat you to the bright shining sun. To the bright shining sun, oh Lord, to the bright shining sun. Tinbrook was a big bay horse, he rode a shaggy mane. He run all around Memphis, he beat the Memphis train. Beat the Memphis train, oh Lord, beat the Memphis train.
It's a pleasure to welcome these two guests to The Reading Life to talk about their remarkable book, The Story of Dan Bright, Crime, Corruption, and Injustice in the Crescent City. Dan Bright is here in the studio with us. In 1995, Dan was wrongfully convicted of the murder of Murray Barnes. He was 26 years old and served 9 years in prison, including 4 on death row, before the Louisiana State Supreme Court reversed that conviction in 2004. With Dan is his co-author, journalist Justin Noble, a freelance magazine journalist who lives in New Orleans and writes about science, the environment, and social justice issues. Dan Bright, welcome to The Reading Life.
Happy to be here.
You too, Justin?
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you.
So this is such an important book. I think every New Orleanian should read it. How did you two come together to do this book, Justin?
I'm an environmental science journalist mainly, and I was sent down here by a magazine to cover the BP oil spill shortly after I moved back. And my partner, Karen, suggested you should get to know the city, and one way to get to know the city is to volunteer. And someone had mentioned this organization called RAE, Resurrection After Exoneration, which is right up on St. Bernard. And they help people who have been wrongfully convicted reenter society, trying to find them jobs, trying to find them housing. So I went there, and it is completely overwhelming going through that door because these people have been through so much. And it was hard as a storyteller to just step in and say, yeah, I'm going to volunteer. What does that mean? Stop by once a month, once a week. I very quickly was drawn into the world of a lot of these people, and it became heated. There was moments there where it was tense, and during one of those moments, a really heated discussion erupted while I was at RAE, and I went outside. I followed this gentleman outside. I smoked a cigarette and cooled off and watching the cars pass on St. Bernard. And he asked me, can you help me with my book? And that was a really big question. And that person was Dan Bright. And I thought about it a little bit, but basically right there and then I said, I think I can help you. And that was 4 years ago.
So Dan, how did you know Justin was the right one to trust with your story?
Look at him. He just has he has something about him, this uh-huh. innocent, honest look, you know. And when I was on death row, I was already taking notes and, you know, writing my story, but I didn't know how to put it all in a professional manner. Uh-huh. So it was a connection. I can't really explain it. It was just a feeling I had that I can trust it. And I think I made the right choice.
Well, I do too. Now that I've read the book, I know you made the right choice. So one of the things that I love about this book is that it's such a brutally honest story of how people live in a city and how a city lives inside a person. And I was going to ask you, Dan, if you would read just that paragraph. It's at the very beginning of the book, but it's when you're in Angola and you begin thinking about New Orleans.
Oh, sure. I am escorted to C2, down a long concrete hallway, cell 12. There's iron toilet, iron zinc, iron bunk, with a little plastic mattress. A tiny table attached to the wall. We have like 2-foot lockers for my clothes, personal belongings, legal work, few books. All in all, you have these 2-foot lockers to put all your personal belongings in. It's not enough, but we have to stuff it in now. Who's in cell 12? Someone yelled. I didn't reply. I don't want to build a relationship up with anyone who is going to be executed. I'm still convinced that things will be straightened out, that I will be released. I sit there on this little mattress, and I think. I go back to the beginning, back to the city that was my home. The city that formed me, the city that framed me, wrongfully convicted me, and sent me to death row for murder to be executed. My story is compelling. This city nourished me and became a part of me. And it wasn't always a good part. Despite everything, I loved that city. And the city where almost all the people I love and live at. It's my story, but even when I read it, I get emotional. So.
Sure. That's the thing. I got emotional reading it, too, because this is a real New Orleans story. It's a story of growing up, of becoming a man here, of life in the projects, which had both its good and bad qualities in your life, and the women you loved, the children you had, and the opportunities you saw before you. And though you began as a drug dealer, you really hoped eventually that you would move to the countryside, that you would have legitimate businesses. Those were your dreams, right?
Exactly. My whole mission was to sell drugs just to help me go into the legitimate in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, oh, I just want to be this big-time drug dealer and sell drugs all my life. It was a means to an end.
And you, one of the things you demonstrate so vividly is that once you're in, you're in.
Exactly.
You can't get out. Yeah. You really can't get out.
I think Dan does a good job of building the world of Angola and what it's like to be up there. And really, it's a world where even if you legitimately did your crime, you didn't necessarily get a fair trial. And the moral and legal groundwork, the whole idea of a prison, it becomes very shaky at that point when you already see that there is some erosion of this system.
Well, it's so fascinating that you were sent to Angola knowingly. You know, they knew you weren't guilty. And you had to fight and struggle so long to get this one piece of paper that would exonerate you. And there's this one moment in this book, Dan, that is so stunning when you finally get it and you don't show it to your lawyer right away. It's so huge in your life.
When I received it, me and my attorney had built this relationship. It goes beyond attorney-client. Me and Benny became like real good friends.
And we're talking about Ben Cohen
Ben
here.
Ben Cohen, yeah. Real, real good friends. And in his document, it has some in-depth things that I was afraid if I showed to him, we would no longer be friends or he would look at me a different way, you know. When I did decide to give it to him, I didn't want to chance it in the mail because the corruption in the prison system, they would take it and throw it away. So I held on to it till I seen him in person and I gave it to him. But even though this document would set me free, this relationship I had built with this guy, this attorney, I didn't want to jeopardize it, even if it would cost me my life.
Wow.
You know.
Now, one of the things that interested me when you're talking about your time in Angola, you talk a lot about how books became important to you.
Yeah.
That there were certain books everybody in Angola mastered.
You know, I tell guys, you have to entertain your mind. If you don't entertain your mind will entertain itself. And yeah. you don't want that. So I give guys books to read, but there's full books. If you read these books, you will become superior, so to speak. It's nothing no one can lie to you about. You will see through certain lies. You know, U.S. Constitution, the Bible, 48 laws of power, and a criminal code of procedure. If you master these four books, you will feel that no one can ever take you on a ride. You know, no one can lie to you. Because these four books, it makes you feel not just superior, just make you feel enlightened. And I suggest that anybody who's like to read those four books, they all really coincide with one another.
That's a pretty heavy-duty reading list, though, for anybody. I found that very impressive. Now, I know that your hope for this book, because I think every book is a hope, your hope for this book is to keep this from happening to other people.
Yeah.
At rock bottom, and also to get your story out. But from my point of view as well, it is a really important picture of life in New Orleans, both the limitations and the opportunities here. And Dan, that was such a miscarriage of justice, such a loss of time, which is the great gift that we all have in our life. How did it change you to write this book with Justin?
I had a lot of stuff bottled up in me just to get everything out. It felt like a relief, you know. I had so much anger in me, and it was the only way to relieve it. I don't have this much anger to hurt anyone, but it just, this is my way of exposing the people that done this to me, you know, and not just that, to enlighten the younger generation. There's no retirement plan for drug dealers. You know, there's no rainbow at the end.
Right.
And I had to learn that the hard way. So this is my mission, just to enlighten these younger guys from hurting one another and selling drugs to one another and exposing the corruption in our so-called justice system.
Well, it's an unforgettable picture of the city and it's and of your lives. It's such an act of generosity on both your parts. I mean, for you, Justin, to spend all this time writing someone else's story, and for you, Dan, to share that story, to find someone you trust with it. There's a lot we can learn from this relationship, and there's a lot the whole city can learn from this book, I think. We've been talking with Dan Bright and Justin Noble, whose new book is The Story of Dan Bright, Crime, Corruption, and Injustice in the Crescent City. You can meet them Friday, November 18th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Friends of the University of New Orleans Library hold their fall book sale Tuesday, November 15th and Wednesday, November 16th from 10 a.m. to 6 at the UNO Library, 4th floor. T.A. Barron signs Atlantis Lost Tuesday, November 15th at 4 at Octavia Books. Nick Maneri signs The Infinite, Tuesday, November 15th at 6 at Octavia Books, and appears again in discussion with Katie Simpson-Smith, Friday, November 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Danielle A. Van signs The Whiz Bang Machine, Tuesday, November 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Rowan Jacobson signs The Essential Oyster, A Salty Appreciation of Taste and Temptation, Wednesday, November 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kathy Finn signs Tom Benson, A Billionaire's Journey, Wednesday, November 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Blood Jet Poetry Series hosts Fiction Night with Peyton Burgess, author of The Fry Pans Aren't Sufficing, and Allison Barker, Wednesday, November 16th at 8 at BJ's in Bywater. The Dogfish Reading Series presents Sam Ligon, author of Among the Dead and Dreaming and Safe in Heaven Dead, and Drift and Swerve. And Kate Lebo, author of Pie School, Lessons in Fruit, Flour, and Butter, and A Commonplace Book of Pie. That's Thursday, November 17th from 7 to 10 at 2448 North Fillory. The two also appear at the New Orleans Healing Center Saturday, November 19th. Kate Lebo will present The Night Will Erase You, an erasure workshop. And Sam Ligon presents Flash Fiction, The Annihilating Form. Tickets are available at eventbrite.com. Today's guests, Dan Bright and Justin Noble, signed The Story of Dan Bright, Crime, Corruption, and Injustice in the Crescent City, Friday, November 18th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. The New Orleans Comics and Zine Fest celebrates independent comics, zines, and art. It takes place at the Main Library Saturday, November 19th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. and Sunday, November 20th from 1 to 4. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Gates of the Forest by Elie Wiesel, Saturday, November 19th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Peggy Scott Laborde, signs The Fairgrounds Through the Lens, Photographs and Memories of Horse Racing in New Orleans, Saturday, November 19th at 1 at Octavia Books. Anne Byrne signs American Cake, From Colonial Gingerbread to Classic Lair, the stories and recipes behind more than 125 of our best-loved cakes, Sunday, November 20th at 2 at Octavia Books. S.R. Perricone signs The Shadows of Nazareth, Sunday, November 20th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Suzanne Payton signs Virginia's Diary, Tuesday, November 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. John DeSantis signs The Thibodeau Massacre, Racial Violence and the 1887 Sugarcane Strike, Tuesday, November 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. And here's some good news. Crescent City Books announces CCB, a new publishing imprint with sister store Commonwealth Books. After publishing poetry, CCB is now venturing into New Orleans prose, written in a fresh style and voice. For more information, visit Crescent City Books or write ccbsubmissions@gmail.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading. ¶¶